Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Well, hello again, everybody. My name is Bob, and I am an alcoholic. I'm so grateful to be here this weekend with all of you. I'm having a wonderful time, and you know, these weekends are just fabulous, and those of us that are involved in service, and the deeper we go, there's just more and more of these kind of events, and these are just supercharges for sobriety. You know, if you're ever at a point and you haven't been to one of these for 6 months, 8 months, or whatever, maybe you're like, feeling a little flat here and there, you come to one of these and it just brings you up, you know. And being involved in service like this, I've had such a wonderful opportunity to just come to so many of these and just keep on going. And it's just, I feel so grateful for this opportunity and these opportunities like this. And but I hail from Massachusetts. I think I mentioned that earlier, and I mentioned earlier this afternoon I'd introduce myself a little bit closer so you could get to know a little bit about me, a little bit more, and sharing my story and that type of thing. But, you know, if you were here this afternoon, you heard me talking for 45 minutes or so. If you're just here now, you've heard me talking for 2 minutes or so. And that's usually enough when you hear that I'm from Massachusetts and you're like, you don't sound like you're from Massachusetts. I get that a lot. So I live in the western part of the state in a little town called Westfield. It's a city, actually. Probably get more tax dollars that way. That's why we call ourselves a city. But nonetheless, I live on the western side of the state, and we don't talk funny out there on the western side of the state. I do understand Bostonian, like ka, paki ka, you know, that sort of thing, but I don't speak it that much. So we're very different. So, you know, and so I'm always like trying to fit in, and then I come down here, and I know I have the accent down here, but we have a wonderful, and many of you might have met, we have a wonderful Class A trustee emeriti, Ward Ewing, who many of you might have known, and he's from down in these parts, and he's taught me how to talk when I come to places like this, right? So I'm going to try and say, ha! Maybe that's more like Alabama. I don't know, where's Jim? Is he here? But ha! That's how he does that. And I've learned that to use y'all and all y'all is plural, right? So here I am from Massachusetts, and I'm starting to, these words or phrases are rubbing off at me, and my fellow employers are going, where the heck have you been? So anyway, only in AA, and it's just so great. I love your hospitality. You've all been so kind to me, and I'm a member of the Holyoke Group, which is in Holyoke, Massachusetts, the next town over from me. And the claim to fame for Holyoke is it's the birthplace of volleyball. And, you know, that's a useless fact probably. But anyway, and just the other side of me is Springfield, Massachusetts, which I'm sure some of you might have heard of a sport called basketball. And that's the home of basketball and the Basketball Hall of Fame. So anyway, I've been a member of the Holyoke Group for many years of my sobriety, and we've been putting continuous meetings on for, I think we're celebrating 73 years or so next month on Thursdays and Sundays, and a strong group, two-speaker meeting, and it's saved me in so many ways. And I just wanted to open, too, with a couple of thank yous to Ernie for showing me such great hospitality and inviting me here, and he represented you so well at the conference, honestly. I mean that sincerely, and watched him, and he's full of courage and a wonderful personality, and thank you so much for your friendship and your service to AA. And Rebecca, I served 2 years of my trusteeship with her as well, too, as a fellow conference delegate. We're all conference delegates, and Rebecca asked me to come be here with you in 2015, but I had to go to Italy, so I couldn't come. I wanted to come here, but, you know, board commitments take precedent. Anyway, so I'm so glad that Ernie asked me to come back, because I was so sorry to have to cancel that. I had committed to come here, and I did have to go to Italy, so. Anyway, and the participation that you've... that you've allowed me to be involved in here this week, and it's just great to sit in on many of your meetings and learn about your structure, and I'll take it with me everywhere I go. And you know, I mean this sincerely, too. We hear in Alcoholics Anonymous that friendships in AA are lasting. And the longer I stay sober in AA, the more people I meet like you. It really mean that, especially in the advent of Facebook. You know, I leave places like this and make friends and see people, you know, from then you run into each other down the road at a convention, and it's like you never missed each other. And that's such a blessing for all of us in AA and keeps us connected and in the center of AA, you know, which is so important. So in any event, you know, I've always been taught when I share that to share what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and that equates, in my view, to experience, strength, and hope. Those three things. And so, I the longer I'm sober, the more that I really see myself as such a textbook alcoholic, and identification runs deeper with speakers I hear from podiums. And I remember feeling different from my earliest memory. I never knew any different than what I felt. I never knew it was different. I just thought it was, you know. And always that square peg trying to fit in the round hole. And from my earliest days, that discomfort that I felt that I didn't even know how to identify, I started to cover up with external things and try to make myself feel good, you know, with things on the outside. It started with athletics with me. And it's not that I didn't like the sports I played. I love them, but it was definitely an out for me to be able to kind of cover up some. I was on skates when I was 2. I was playing hockey when I was 5. And I loved it. I loved every bit of it. And I remember my father would tell me, give 110% today, Bobby, and I would give 150. You know, I just went at everything like as hard as I ever could. But I grew up in an alcoholic home, and again, I didn't know any different. And from around that time when your memories start, like 5 years old when I started playing hockey, I also remember coming home from kindergarten and not being able to find my mother. And I'd have to go get the neighbor because I was afraid to check downstairs in the basement. And she would go down there with me and hold my hand, and there would be my mother passed out on the floor, drunk. And I didn't know she was drunk. You know, later on she would, whatever, my neighbor got her up, and later on I'd see her thrown up in the toilet, and, you know, she said she slipped and hit her head and it made her feel sick, and I believed her. I didn't know any different. And so I grew up in that environment, and I have an older brother and an older sister. My sister's like almost 7 years older than I am, 6.5, 7 years older than me, and my brother is 2.5 years ahead of me. I'm the youngest of 3, and my father, he was out a lot working. He was a salesman, so I didn't, you know, so much interact with him like I did with my siblings as much at that time, other than like hockey games on weekends and things like that. But anyway, my mother. Or my father, I should say, my father, he drank as well, but I didn't really see a lot of my father's drinking. Like I said, he was out a lot at night. And I have this one memory from back in that early time, however old I was, 5 or 8 or 9 or something, and my father was running up and down the street in a Tarzan outfit, pounding his chest and yelling out, and it wasn't Halloween, and so kind of figure something might be wrong with him too, maybe, you know. So there were eggshells growing up, and my sister was really good. She took care of me and my brother, I guess. My brother probably took care of me too. I was little, and you know, there were eggshells, and so, you know, the code was like mom's woozy, and it was like, okay, get out of Dodge and go whatever you got to do. And that was kind of the ticket. So I always say this, that I'm going to stop qualifying my parents, and then I do it all the time and forget. But it is part of my story, and it is a family disease. But my father one day came home from work, and he said, "Your mother is going to detox." And I didn't know what that was. And so I found out, you know, what that was. She went to a detox to sober up, and she actually went to like a 30-day treatment program, Brattleboro Retreat, I think it was, up in Vermont, and when they used to do terms like that long, and And she jumped into AA with both feet when she got back. I was 9 years old, and she embraced AA with everything she had. And it was like our family was assembled, not even reassembled, but assembled for the first time. And she became a woman like I didn't necessarily know before. She was just always there and wonderful. And I went to meetings with my mother all the time. I loved it. I loved AA. I would go to tons of meetings with her all the time, everywhere. The dirtier, darker the basement, the better. And especially when they had flypaper, I could watch the fly struggle. And, you know, I'm like nine going. Then the next day, Mom, when are we going to that? Can we go to that one down in this place? And, you know. And she took me everywhere, and I loved it. I loved the people, and she got active in service, and, you know, we have phone coverage where I live, and I'm sure you probably do things like that too, and she would take phone coverage, and I do that. I haven't in the last 4 years. I've been not around enough, but whenever I've taken phone coverage, you know, my cell phone's next to my bed, and I turn it up, and if it rings, I get up, and my mother would go downstairs in our finished basement with the phone, and she would, you know, we had a phone. She'd sit down there, drink coffee, and smoke cigarettes all night long, waiting for people to call. She was really into service to AA. People called us all the time from sponsees that she had and different people, and they'd be coming in and out, and sometimes people would be coming in, and they would be like a wreck. I'd be like, oh my God, you know. And my mom would, you know, put her arm around them, and she was really, really active and focused. And then my father got sober when I was 11. And so I started going to meetings with him and my mom too. They'd take me all over. And so as I said, I have an older brother and an older sister, and my sister was away at college. This is when my time came, and I didn't expect that it would. I never wanted to be like my mother or my father, particularly my mother. I never wanted to be an alcoholic. And from what I heard and saw at meetings, I really swore off to that. And my sister came back from college one weekend with some of her girlfriends. And so she figured she was going to have a party. Well, my parents were out at the Wilbraham Friday night meeting. What better time to do that, right? So I was there. I was like an innocent bystander. My brother was there, and that was the first and the last time that I ever drank Southern Comfort. I puked and peed my pants and passed out, and I couldn't wait to do it again. I have a vague recollection of trying to make out with a 23-year-old girl. She's pushing me away, telling me to call her in 10 years, which incidentally was when I came to AA for, you know, since I've been here since then, which my sponsor would not have been happy if I hooked up with her at 23 years old in my first year of sobriety. But I was a mess. But, you know, it's like when I remember that day, I remember that so clearly when that happened. And it was like when I had that drink, it was like for the first time in my whole life, I just felt like, exhale. The knots were gone that I never knew I had, you know? I was like, wow, I've been feeling this. And it was like this release and this elixir of life, like, wow. And then, you know, when I woke up the next day, I felt remorse, and I knew I loved it. I knew I was an alcoholic from the first time I picked up that drink because I loved it, and I was scared. And fast forward to when I came to AA, you know, 10 years later, my higher power, I really believe, led me to this particular meeting. That I was I attended this meeting every Sunday morning for like 8 years. It was a Big Book speaker step discussion meeting. Say that 10 times fast, you know. And it was a pretty structured format. It wasn't really that rigid as it might sound. But the first step was split in half, and I really believe I needed that, because admitting I was powerless over alcohol was easy. All the time that I drank, I would say that all the time, especially drunk, yep, I'm an alcoholic, you know, I didn't care. But my denial lived in the unmanageability portion of the first step. And I did just like I did when I was 5 years old. I built all these things around my life to make me look like I was okay. And even when I finally stopped drinking, people would say to me, like, you didn't seem like you drank much to me. Because I was hiding it, and I didn't even realize that I was doing that. I drank down by the river with a bunch of animals like me, you know, six guys that got crazy and burned trees down and all kinds of crazy stuff, and fell in the river and all these things, and I drank in my apartment by myself. I didn't go to bars too often. So anyway, after that happened, my parents were great 12-steppers. They probably saw an awful lot of alcoholic potential in me and decided that they better not lean down on me too hard. So, but that fear kept me away from drinking until I was 17 years old. And in that time, my isms grew, and I started to date a girl around that time when I was 13 as well. And, you know, I never really liked her. So I dated her for 4 years, all the way through high school. It was awful. Oh, she was miserable. She would yell at me and hoot and holler, and, you know, I didn't experience that with my parents, you know, and I just couldn't get out. I was, like, people-pleasing, and I didn't want to let her go, and I was afraid to be alone, and I was, like, codependent and all this kind of thing, and I was just a wreck, you know. And so through that time, and as I got to be to get to that point of 17, you know, my defiance grew, and I believe that that's a huge characteristic of all of us, defiance. Everybody has that. Adolescents have that, for sure. But for us, it's like on steroids, or at least it was for me. My defiance was on steroids, and it just rose, you know. And by the time I got to be 17, I was just ready to go, you know. And I'll never forget, at 17 years old, I split a six-pack of beer with my boss that was 10 years older than I was. He was 27, I was 17. I drank four beers to his two. He became my best friend, and he was a really good person, no question about it. But, you know, he was a best friend because he could get me alcohol too. You know, there were a lot of benefits with that, and I was just off and running. You know, I had continued to play hockey up to that point, and, you know, I had wanted nothing more to become, to be a Boston Bruin until I was at that point. And, like, once I started drinking, it just went out the door, you know. I was always athletic. I played soccer, hockey, baseball, all these sports I played around hockey to get myself in shape for those seasons and all that kind of stuff. And the alcohol just took me quick, and I was never a good student either, which is definitely a part of my story and me, which I hated. I felt stupid all the time. And I call it, whether it was a learning disability, I don't know, but that I could have outgrown, who knows? I really think that it was just this massive insecurity, this no inner security at all, that I did not believe in myself and that I could do anything. And I would study for hours, and I'd just be shut down, and I would see these blank pieces of paper. I could read, but I just couldn't focus and didn't believe I could do it. And so I went to a Catholic school for 12 years, and my teachers would always say, Bobby has so much potential. Why can't you be like your brother, you know, or your sister? And because I'm not, you know. And so I managed to I got to that point at 17, I finally broke up with that girl. I finally gained the courage to do that. And so I broke up with her. And around that time, too, when I was graduating from high school, my mom decided that she was starting to have some trouble reconciling her spirituality, or with her religion and with her spirituality within Alcoholics Anonymous. And that wasn't something that she really had always dealt with. So there was definitely a change that had happened. She had been in AA for, I guess, 8 or 9 years or so at this particular point. And so she decided to leave, and my father just kind of followed her and did that too. And my brother and sister were long gone. I had been drinking for 1 year at this point. I was a full-blown alcoholic after 1 year. I was still playing hockey, but it was more about drinking on the bench than it was playing hockey. And I started to let my body go and all the things that I had to do to play hockey, because I started smoking cigarettes, and like three packs of cigarettes a day, and I just was such an addictive kind of a person, you know. So anyway, I graduated from high school barely. My brother and sister were gone, and my father, I was not getting along with my mother at all. And my father encouraged me to enroll in community college, and I was like, I could hardly get out of high school. Why should I go to college? But my father always had a lot of influence in my life when I was younger, and I'm so grateful that he he did that, encouraged me that direction. So I did that. I went to community college, and I decided to move out of the house at the same time at 18 years old. And so much freedom came to me at that point. And I didn't have people looking over my shoulder. I could drink whenever I wanted. I made alcoholic decisions from the get-go, leaving home. I had a job. I didn't own a car, so I had a job that I could walk to. And I would, and you know, I made like $5.50 an hour. So I quit that job, and I got a job in Springfield, which was a 35-minute bus ride for a 50-cent cut in pay. But it was at a liquor store. Which was perfect. I mean, the benefits were great, you know. And so that was one more thing, you know. It's so easy to get drunk, and there started going my ups and downs, and I started learning how to manipulate life. And I would I'd wake up and I'd miss exams, 8 o'clock classes, 10 o'clock classes, 2 o'clock classes, whatever they were, and. I would manipulate, lie, and say whatever I had to say to get out of my troubles in school. I think my grandparents died like 14 times. Dog ate my homework, you name it, whatever it was. And I would just manipulate my way through. And around that time, in that first semester of community college, I met a girl at another college that I had gone to go drinking at. And, you know, she was like, great, I like this one, you know. And she was pretty, and she was focused, and she was smart, and she was kind, and we talked well together. She was on a 4-year plan to get a degree in psychology, which that'd be great for me too, you know. And then she planned to go to Springfield College and get a master's degree for 2 years, and that's exactly what she did. Me, on the other hand, I was on like the 9-year plan, you know. First time I said that from here, I thought that sounded like that flowed, like 9 years plan, and it turned out it really was 9 years when I sat down and thought it out, you know. I was being sarcastic at first, but it was 9 years. I finished college in AA, actually, when I got sober. So anyway, I was like 19 years old. I was dating this girl. She was one more thing to make my life look good on the outside. And, you know, and I was a basket case. I was on academic probation one semester. Then I'd make the dean's list the next semester to get out of Dodge, you know. Yeah, I was lucky. I think I ended up with like a C average by the time I was done because I was up and down so much, you know. So it sort of just like evened out in the middle. But in any event, when I was 20 years old, the following year, I started to work in my family's business. My great-grandfather started a business in 1923, and so I was $20 a month short in my bills, I asked my father if he could give me a job to keep me busy for that, and I've been there ever since. So I started to work there, but I was a joke, and he was happy that I was there. He wanted me to take over the business someday. He always thought that for me. But I was a mess. I couldn't work. It's like a sales service organization. You have to be able to get out of yourself some. And I would walk into that office every morning, and people would say good morning to me, and all look at me, and I would turn red and go down in the basement and sweep the floor. You know, I just couldn't do it, you know. And so they put a tie around me and took my picture and put it in the paper and be like, here's our boy, you know. And my face is all bloated of alcohol. And if you stuck a pin in me, I'd start squirting beer out of my pores, you know. I loved beer. That was my drink of choice. And I loved it. And but it was like one more thing on the outside. And so time kind of progressed for me, and I was dating this girl for like 4 years at this point, and just kind of existing, and that seemed to be the only steady thing in my life. And so she graduated from college, and on her graduation day, I decided that I was going to propose to her, in which I did. And she said yes, and that was great. That was one more thing. So now I was engaged, and I would look okay with that too. And so we were engaged for about a year, and in about 3 months before we were going to get married, she approached me one day, and she said, Bob, I want a separation from you. And I was like absolutely floored, and I was like, well, you're coming back, aren't you? And she said, yeah. So I said, yeah. And a week later, she came back and gave me the ring back, and she was gone, and that was it, you know. And that year that we were engaged, that moment that when I got engaged, I look, hindsight is 20/20, and I look back at that, and something, a switch flipped inside of me, and, you know, I didn't want to be a drunk husband or drunk father. I didn't want to be like my mother, my father, and I was trying to swear off during that year. And I would wake up in the morning during that time leading up to that point when she left me, and I would wake up and I would swear off that I wasn't going to drink anymore. And usually I was hurting with a hangover, and then around 3 in the afternoon I'd say, well, maybe I was a little hasty with that decision, and I would end up at the package store, buy a case of beer, end up drunk, fall down the stairs, wake up in my puke, drive, not know where I went, not know where my car was, not know what I did, who I was with. All those great things that happen to us when we drink, you know. And so anyway, that was it. And, you know, in that last year, well, I would drink from those times, that alcohol was not working for me anymore. Sometimes I could drink in huge quantities. Like, I remember Sundays were a big day for me, the way my schedules worked. And whenever I came to in the morning, I'd start drinking from the night before. And I would drink sometimes all day. And like at 11 o'clock at night, I might have put a whole case of beer away. And I would be like, no problem, officer, I'm fine, you know. And I felt completely normal. And another time, I would drink 3/4 of a beer, and I would be annihilated, you know. And my liver hurt, my side hurt, I assume it was my liver, you know. And but all that physical stuff aside, what it did for me, that exhale that I talked about that first time I drank, I chased that for all the years I drank, and I couldn't get that anymore. It was gone. And so what I had realized when she left was that I was just an empty shell of a young man. I was 23 years old. The God of my childhood was out of my life. I kicked him out, and I just didn't pay attention. So I was completely empty spiritually. The alcohol didn't work. She was gone. I had nothing. I can't convey to you the sense of loneliness and aloneness that I felt. Alcoholism really is the lonely disease, you know, and it certainly was for me. And that was it. I had turned completely suicidal, just like that. And I quit work, I quit school, I quit everything. I drew the blinds, and I just laid on the floor in the fetal position in my living room with a knife this long next to me that I just stared at, contemplating driving it through my chest, falling on that knife. And I remember staring at that knife and coming so close to taking my life. And you know, at this point in time, you know, for years I was getting drunk and calling crisis intervention at night and psychic hotline to find out my future. And I get the phone bill, I'd be like, 1-900, what? Oops. And, oh my God. That was the least of my worries, really. $800 phone bill. But I would call people and I wouldn't remember. I was a blackout drinker all the time. And my higher power gave me the gift of a lot of gray outs over time too, brownouts, whatever you want to call them, where I'd remember bits and pieces. And so anyway, one night, one morning, I guess it was, I woke up and I heard a knock on the door. And I looked out the window and there was a cruiser in my driveway. And I thought, oh God, I did it. I killed somebody. I drove drunk all the time, or I don't know what I did. And so I figured I just would just put my arms out when I opened the door and say, go ahead and arrest me. Whatever you say, I'm sure I did it, you know. So I opened the door, and there they were, two cops. And they said, we're coming to take you away. For any of you that remember Dr. Demento, right? Yeah. Yeah. Someday I'm going to say that and people are going to go, huh? Who's that? Glad there's some of you out there anyway. But, you know, it was it. I had got on the phone that night evidently, or it was probably 5 minutes before, and I didn't remember talking to crisis intervention. I was talking to them about my suicide, and the cops were there to take me to a mental locked facility because they were concerned for my safety. So I kicked the cops out of my apartment. I'm like, you can't, I know my rights, you can't take me. And I kicked them out, but they planted a seed, you know. And later that night, nights were really hard for me, and I was within a millimeter, a nanosecond of taking my life. I remember being over that knife and just ready to go and let it let it go through my chest, and I would be over, and I wouldn't have to deal with any of my pain anymore. And I put the knife down, and I got in my car, and I drove to that locked psych ward. And that was such a gift for me. And you know, especially because fast forward a few weeks from that, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And when you're young, and I know we're all looking for reasons to be different, when you're young and you're looking around and you're seeing people that are like my age now or whatever, or older, you're thinking that you don't fit, and you're reading the book, and you might not even have the intellectualness to understand some of the stories. And I'll never forget, like, early on reading that alcoholism leads us to jails, institutions, and death. And I was like, well, I got a lot of yets, but institutions, I'm there, and I know I was close to death, you know, and so I identified. And so I checked myself into that locked ward. I was there for a couple of weeks, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me, you know. I think they had meetings in there. I don't really remember them. But one thing I can tell you what happened to me at that moment when I went into that locked ward was that I gained gratitude. You know, I realized there are people in this world that are worse off than I am, you know. There are a lot of different people in there for different reasons. And, you know, incidentally, isn't that a great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous? You can always find someone worse off than you. Turn to your right, to your left, behind you. You don't have to tell them about it. You know, you just kind of think it. No, don't. Yeah. Anyway, I got gratitude, and you know, I believe to this day that gratitude is definitely a necessary ingredient for long-term sobriety, and that happened at that moment, and I realized that. And today, to this day, my morning meditation, I have to reach for that. I feel happy and fortunate to say that it comes to me pretty naturally in most of that morning meditation, that I feel that gratitude for my sobriety, for all the wonderful things that I've been given in my life, and my thinking of my family and my trusteeship and my service to AA and all these other things that have been such huge highlights for me. But sometimes it's not there because I wake up with a resentment and I'm trying to fight that off and I can't focus on the third step prayer and I got to say it 9 times before I can feel it, and the 7 step prayer is like out the window and, you know, all that kind of thing. But I know if I don't, then I have to make a list or do whatever I need to do and focus on that. So anyway, I got out of there and I ended up in a bar after I got out of there, and some old hockey buddies of mine took me out drinking one night, and this was the last time that I ended up drinking, and they wanted to cheer me up, and so I'm in the bar, and the bartender was a guy I used to play hockey with, and I was crying into my beer bottle, talking to him, telling him all my problems, and I fished $8 and quarters into the jukebox. I played the song The End by The Doors over and over again. I was such a downer. And I'm singing into my beer bottle. This is like a brownout, grayout. This is the end, you know, and I'm going, my only friend, the end. And I'm like, mother, and I'm going crazy in the bar, and father, and the next thing you know, I had two very large men picked me up. And they dragged me out of the bar. They ripped the cord out of the jukebox, and they threw me in my car, and I drove home drunk for the 450th time, you know, and never got a DWI, a big yet for me. I deserved them plenty of times. I drove drunk every day for 6 years practically, and I got home in my apartment. I don't know what time it was, and again, a gift of a gray out, I'm drinking a beer, I remember, and my father comes around the corner. And I was like, what are you doing here? He said, you called me. I was like, oh, God, I didn't remember. I'm like, ugh. So he starts arguing with me. And then the next thing you know, in the midst of the argument, I'm arguing back with him. And I ended up slamming that half a beer on the coffee table saying, "Fine, Dad, you want to hear me say it? My name is Bob and I'm an alcoholic." And he looked at me and he kind of snickered a little bit. And he said, "No kidding, I'm glad you finally figured it out." Oh, God. And but you know, I share this every time I speak, and this is such a miracle because I was in such a drunken state at the time, honestly. And for me to put a half of any drink down was what me and my friends used to call alcohol abuse. And and I slammed that beer down, and that was it. And I have not felt it necessary to pick up a drink from that moment to this. And that's just a miracle for me, you know. And the only way that I can convey the way that I felt at that time was that a few days later when I got into AA, I picked up a big book. And I knew what one was, and for some reason I was reading the spiritual appendix in the back. I probably wanted to find out the answer, right? So I'll read a novel, I'll be like, "I'll read the last chapter, I can't wait," you know? And I was reading the spiritual experience, and it defines a spiritual experience as a personality shift sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. And for me, at that time, and even this, that's a lot to, you know, intellectually to kind of take in, but it spoke to my heart. And that's what happened to me. And I knew it was the booze, and it was just released from me, and it's been gone ever since. And to try to tell you how I felt then was that if I didn't drink up to that day, that moment, for those 6 years before up to that point, that I just felt like if alcohol didn't touch my stomach, go down my throat, and I would have to reach down in my throat and just rip my stomach out. You know, I just had to have alcohol. And all of a sudden, I didn't, you know. And so I detoxed on my couch for a couple of days, and my father directed me to a meeting. And I went to that meeting, and there was a very kind man that put his arm around me. Thank God for that. Thank God for that kindness. And he told me I was going to be okay. And I don't remember a whole lot there. I was in a lot of misery. Someone told me to go to a meeting the next day. And I did. And I remember sitting in that meeting, and this guy looked at me, and he said, "You need a sponsor." I said, "I know." And I said, "Ask him." I said, "Okay." And I looked at this guy and I said, "Would you sponsor me?" He said, "Sure." And he's been my sponsor for 24 years. You know, I celebrated 24 years on March 30th. And we've been together all these years, you know. And that's just a miracle. And, you know, he was so kind to me and so good to me. And he just loved me back to health. And, you know, he was firm, but he wasn't mean, you know, and he told me what I needed to hear. And, you know, and now we have this sort of special understanding when I hear, it's kind of like that movie, "What About Bob?" You know, he'll go, "Bob, Bob, Bob." And I'll be like, "Okay, all right, you're right." You know, but he was there for me and he directed me. And in early sobriety was tough, you know. My motives weren't that pure when I got here. I think I wanted my fiancée to come back, and if she did, I probably would have been like, "See you later, AA," and off I would have gone. And, you know, she didn't come back. And some days I was on a pink cloud, and other days I was miserable. Some days I would plot before meetings that I was going to get drunk after the meeting. I'd have it all planned out that I was going to go to this liquor store, get a 12-pack, and get drunk. And I'd show up at the meeting and somebody would give me a raffle ticket and I'd win a book. And I got incidents, right? No coincidences. And I'd look up at my higher power like, "Okay, one more day. That's all you're getting, you know?" And you know, I haven't won a book in like 23 and a half years now. Everybody else wins, but I won them every week, it seemed like then. I had a whole library full. And so, you know, I got to a point, I was around a year sober, and I was getting a little squirrely, I think, and a little resentful, and my sponsor identified that, and he looked at me, and he said, "Bob, you really need to go through the steps." And I said, "I know, you're right, I do." And I was just so willing as the dying could be. There was nowhere else for me to go in the world, and I did what he told me to do, and he directed me on how to take the steps and took me through them. And I'll never forget, I did my fifth, sixth, and seventh step on a Saturday afternoon in a matter of about 4.5 hours. And I was rocketed into the fourth dimension, you know. And from that point to this, I have wanted to do nothing but practice all the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps, traditions, and the concepts, as enthusiastically as I can. And that's really what I've set out to do and what my hope is on a daily basis today. And it was just a very profound effect for me. And I continued on, and I did a simple eighth and a ninth step, and the 10th, 11th, and 12th step are certainly maintenance steps for me, you know. And right around this time when I was going through this, I remember being at a meeting, and where I live in our service structure, our area committee will go out, it's like a 32-member body now, whatever it is, and they would get volunteers, and they would get these commitments going out to various groups, and they would do what they call service commitments, and they would share their stories, experience, strength, and hope as it related to their experience in service, you know. So this guy got up to the podium, and I'm sitting right in the front row, and I remember he was from our institutions committee. Some people call it H&I or whatever, and Encompass Treatment and all this sort of thing, and corrections and jails and stuff. And he said, watch the people that are active in service, and watch their faces and their smiles. They're truly happy. And I heard that, and I was like, that's what I want. I want to be that kid that I was when I was skating around that ice and had that zest for life before I drank and went to meetings with my mom and all those kinds of fun times and stuff. And so he inspired me, you know, with his enthusiasm and his love for service in AA. And I showed up at that institution's meeting the next first Wednesday of the month. And I had no idea what to expect. And at the time, they used to call the rollout of all the open meetings that needed sponsors and alternates. And they said, Noble Hospital, Tuesday night, sponsor and alternate open. And I said, I'll take that. And I didn't even know what I was doing. And the Noble Hospital Tuesday night meeting was the locked ward that I was locked in before I came to AA. And it was just like natural. It gives me goosebumps to think about it. It was like natural to put my hand up. And so for 2 years, I brought a meeting into that facility. And what an amazing experience to hear that door slam behind me and be able to get out. When I wanted, I tried to get out for the 2 weeks I was there, you know. I made a mistake. You got the wrong guy, really. And I would bring cigarettes and change into the people that were in the meetings, you know, whatever it took to get them there, you know. And I know what I wanted when I was there. But, you know, I got gratitude again by doing that. And it was, you know, when you have to get two speakers every week for meetings like that, you know, it's not easy. You got to go to a lot of meetings and ask a lot of people. And for everyone in AA that says that they never say no, bull. Bull. Oh, man. Talk about having to learn rejection, you know? Man, it was good for my sales career, I guess. So I did that, and then my GSR from my home group, she was playing on me. She knew what to do, and she said, Bob, you know what? She said, I think you would make a great alternate GSR. And I was like, of course I would. You know? And so I was an alternate GSR. And I went every month to the meeting with her. And I didn't just go because she couldn't go. I went every week and I learned. And then she rotated and I became the GSR. And then the DCMs kept quitting. And so I ended up, and I showed up. So they said, you be the DCM. I don't even know if it was a real election, you know. And so I was the DCM, and, you know, and I tried to do the best that I could. And so so I served as the DCM, and you know, through this time as well, things in my life got better. I stepped up to the plate in my family's business, and I got educated. I finished college, and I got licensed in my profession and designations and all these kinds of things, and was kind of taking all that forward. And you know, like if I go backwards some to like my first week of meetings, I remember going in the back row of this meeting and looking up to the front row, and there was this girl walking into the front rows, like shimmying between the seats, and I was like, "Whoa, I'm not supposed to look at her." My sponsor said I can't do this. Whoever came up with that, anyway. No, it was right for me, really, you know. But this, oh wow. Knocked my socks off, you know. But I stayed away. And, you know, so after being sober for about a year and a half or two, and going doing the service things and trying to take care of myself and going through the steps, you know, I kind of knew where she was and who she was. And I never really talked to her. And I heard she was going to be going to this AA dance. I know there's no such thing, just bear with me anyway. So I went to this AA dance, and I was real scared to go, and I went in, and I ran into, there's like 500 people there. So I ran into the dance, and I sat down as fast as I could, And there were a bunch of people up dancing, and she came and she sat next to me. And I was like, oh, she might like me, you know. And I felt like such a dork. I didn't know what to say. I had no experience with, you know, relationships and sober and talking to girls or anything. And it was all just polluted drunk before that. And so I was afraid to give her my number. I didn't know what to do. You know, I wanted to talk to her, so I gave her my business card. Because I wanted her to call me, you know, and I was afraid to ask her for her number. And I was just looking the other day in one of our photo albums. She's my wife today. And my business card with the folded corners of her nerves picking at the corners of my business card are sitting in the album that we have in one of our photo albums. But I asked her on a date like a week later, and she said no. I was like... She said, I'm busy. I'm like, yeah, washing your hair. But she really was. And I told my sponsor, he's like, Bob, take her for her word. You know, and she said, ask me again sometime. And I said, okay. And so I asked her again, and she said yes. And so we started to go on these dates, and they were like AA dates, you know. And we were like Michael and Apollonia Corleone from The Godfather, you know, when they're in Sicily. And we'd be like walking on this AA date going bowling, and we'd have like 12 old timers 40 feet behind us going, you two be careful, you know. We're like, we've been sober 18 months. We got this. We're good. We're fine, you know. Oh, man. But you know what? We had a courtship, and she wouldn't let me in her house, and I didn't want to go in her house, and I wouldn't kiss her, and she wouldn't kiss me. And it was just nice, you know, to get to know her and to get to know each other and to find out. And we would, like, interview each other, like, what step are you on? Who's your sponsor? What do you think of this? And we didn't want to be boy meets girl on AA campus, you know, like it says in the 12 and 12. And, you know, so, you know, we fell in love, and you know, my service continued through this time, and I developed a full and useful life, you know. And so in any event, I was rotating out from being a DCM, and we had just gotten married, and we'll celebrate 20 years in about 3 weeks from now. And we had just gotten married, and we had a child, our first child, Matthew, at this point. And I remember being at the assembly, and I gave my final report at my last assembly, and I kind of gave this little rotation talk and saying, don't worry, if you get elected to something, you'll be fine, you know, it'll be okay. And not thinking, I'm like, my higher power wants me to build my business and have a father and a husband and do all this kind of thing, and I'm done. Service is over for me here. I'm sober for whatever, 6 years now or whatever it was, and 5 years. And so then the elections came, and there was they were electing the alternate delegate position, which was combined with the area chair at that time in my area. And so somebody nominated me, and my wife was next to me, and our little boy in his baby carrier. And they said, "Do you accept, Bob?" And I said, "Sure." And my wife looked at me and she said, "You do?" So much for the service manual and asking your family if they support you and all that stuff. And I learned my lesson, well, sometimes after that. But and I ended up getting elected, and I was petrified. It's a tough job being an area chair, Rebecca. Well, those of us that have been area chairs, we know that. And I learned, and I grew, and I developed, and I had a lot of bullseyes in my back, and a lot of people came at me, and it was hard. A lot of controversy, a lot of personalities, a lot of difficulties, and I did not want to deal with any of that, but service forced me to. And I grew up, and then I got to a point where the delegate position was coming open. That was sort of the next thing, and I was elected delegate from my area. And it was such a blessing. When that happened to me, things really transformed in my life. And those past delegates and Ernie and delegate and current delegate, you know what that's like. You know what that's like to serve at the conference. I can see it in your faces now, and it's just such a honor and a blessing. And you know, I was 32 and 33 at my conferences. At panel 52 delegate, I was in 02 and 03. And they used to call me Young Bob back then, you know. Every time I said my name, Young Bob, I loved it. It was great. And so So anyway, I served in that role. I'll never forget getting to my first conference thinking they picked the wrong one. You know, I'm too young to be here. You know, the average delegate was like 68 years old or whatever it was, you know. And I'm 30, drew the age down a little bit, I guess I did. But, you know, but I came around the corner. I saw the banner on the front of the podium and I was like, I belong here. You know, my higher power wants me here. And I served, and I loved it, and I had so much vigor and enthusiasm, and I ran all over the area, and I gave reports, and I just loved it, and I loved talking to people in service, and just, you know, carrying the message and talking about all these things from GSO, and so with every fabric of my existence, I enjoyed that experience, and I'll never forget that. It was New Year's Eve of 2003, and I'm watching the ball drop with my wife, and it's like 10, 9, 8, and I'm going, I'm still the delegate, Cheryl. I'm still a delegate. You know, oh, I'm not the delegate, you know. And then rotation sets in, you know, and oh, God. So, you know, and it's hard. It took me about 18 months to find my legs after I rotated from being a delegate, but I did, you know. And I made one promise to myself that I did not want to become a bleeding deacon. You'd have to ask my area if I achieved that, you know. But I didn't say much at assembly. Sometimes I didn't think I said enough. Anytime I said anything, I thought I said too much. It's a tough balance sometimes. And so I got to a point where I got comfortable, and I didn't want to become apathetic. I've seen that happen to past delegates, and I think it's such a waste of experience, you know, to see them stop coming, and I didn't want that to happen to me. And I found I just showed up at assemblies, and people gave me enough to do, you know. And I was asked to facilitate tons of inventories. I've done hundreds of inventories and group inventories and district inventories and committee inventories and sponsored people and chaired workshops and mini-conference sessions and you name it, whatever it was. And I always felt fulfilled. And you know, so by the time I rotated from being delegate, my wife and I actually had two more children during that time. We had Joseph and Sarah. And so, you know, I was rotated, and I had a lot more time. So we had three more kids through that time, and it's fun making them, you know. So anyway, that's what married people are supposed to do, right? I can say that. How red am I now? That was stupid. Shouldn't have said that. Anyway, I get carried away sometimes. So I got to a point a few years after I was rotated, and I stood for Northeast Regional Trustee, and I didn't get elected. And I got a few votes, and that was nice, and I kind of moved on my way and kept doing my thing, and I built my career, and we had our kids and more kids. And then I stood for Northeast Regional Trustee again in like 2011, I think it was, or 10, 11, I guess it was, something like that. And I kind of went down a horse race at that point in time, but I didn't get elected. The other guy got elected in like the fourth ballot or whatever. And I thought, you know, it's probably not meant to be, and I was just sort of going to let it go from that point on. I have six children and a business and a very busy life and married and all that kind of thing. In any event, I got a notification that there was a trusteeship, a trustee-at-large position that was coming up in 2013. And you get the letter earlier on in 2012. And so I got that letter from my delegate or whoever, and I went into what I called a discernment phase, which I didn't really do in those other times. And I decided to take that to my higher power in a place that I've become very comfortable with, prayer and meditation. It's a local chapel where I live, and I would try to draw up balance sheets, and I thought about it and prayed about it for months, and talked to my wife about it this time, all my children, and they all thought it would be a good idea. My wife seemed to be maybe waffling some, and the morning of the assembly the following October was where that's the first step in the process, and I was where you have to get nominated by your local area to be your area's candidate. So that morning of the assembly, I was in the shower, getting ready for the assembly, and my wife came in the bathroom, in the bathroom, but anyway, my wife came in, and she was saying, you're going to stand for trustee at large this morning? And I said, well, I don't know. She's like, why not? I think that'd be good for you. And I was like, you really don't mind? And she said, no, I think it'd be good for you. I was like, okay. So I did. And my area nominated me, and that's it. And then you have to wait till April until the election happens at the next conference. And my service sponsor said, go live your life, you know. I developed my resume, and I sent it in, and I went and lived my life. And December 1st of that year, my mother, as I mentioned, left AA in 88, 89-ish, then around that time, about 7 years or so later, she picked up a drink. And she drank up to that point, and it killed her on that day, December 1st, 2012. And she died of alcoholism. And it was very sad, and everything that led up to that through those years she drank was awful. All of our children and my sister's children, even my brother's, even though he's on the West Coast, and we'd have to sort of keep them from her, and it was really difficult. And so she passed, and when she died, my zeal to serve Alcoholics Anonymous just went up 100-fold. And so fast forward to April, and the election time came, and when that... When that day came, I decided the best thing for me to do was to sit in that chapel where I had gone through that process before and wait for my delegate to call me and tell me I didn't get elected. And so I'm sitting in the chapel, and I'm praying and thinking and all that, and this woman walks in with a big book in her arm. And it was a woman that my mom used to sponsor. And there was a woman behind her that didn't look too good, and following her, and they kneeled down behind me, and they did a third step prayer. And I thought, whoa, you know, like, what, wow. You know, I mean, I didn't know I would end up getting elected, and I just thought, for this day that I'm here for this, and this is happening, you know. And my delegate called me shortly after, and he said, you're the Northeast Region's candidate for trustee at large. That's the next step. And so then you're one of six that go to the floor, six to the floor. And so then I ended up being the Northeast Regional's candidate and Region's candidate. And he called me about 2 hours later, and he said you're the next trustee at large U.S. You came out of the hat, and I was like. He later shared, he said, that's the first time I ever saw Bob speechless in all my life. I didn't know what to say. I heard him speechless, and I didn't know what to say. And I was just so moved at that moment. I'll never forget it as long as I live, you know, those calls that I got from him in that day and how that happened. And I really believe that my mom reached in that hat and pulled my name out and said, you know, it's Bobby's time to do this, and I kept her with me all these years that I served, these 4 years that I served, and there's no handbook or rule book on how to do this. In all of our service positions, we've got this little bit of guidance. There's like a paragraph in the service manual, and go serve 4 years around the world, figure it out, you know, and that's kind of what happened, and so I really didn't want anyone to tell me what to do anyway, so anyway, off I went, you know, and we get elected in AA to these service positions for who we are and to be who we are, not to be who we think someone thinks we should be, you know. And I tried to serve in that way through all of my time, and it was such a privilege, just such a privilege. And you know, for me to be elected to this position, and I think back to the time that I was hovering over that knife and with that nanosecond and millimeters from taking my life, and now I was going to be an international delegate and represent Alcoholics Anonymous around the world. You know, why me? I mean, unbelievable. But, you know, with my service spirit experience behind me, I knew that I just had to accept it and do the best that I could. And so I did, I didn't really know what to expect as much as I asked questions and that type of thing, and I knew I'd be away a lot. And, you know, I'll never forget that first international trip. I was in Ecuador for my first Rodella. I showed some pictures of that earlier, you know, and I So I was at that first trip in Ecuador and thinking they picked the wrong guy again. And, you know, one of those treks that I told that they take us out to, like, different places, like up to the mountains or to here and there, we're, like, on the bus forever. And this isn't like your regular Peter Pan bus. This is like the chicken bus, you know, like, you know, you're bouncing all over the place. And I have a translator with me and I don't know what to expect. And we end up on this beach, and the delegate from Mexico, international delegate from Mexico, he's a real boisterous guy, and they're playing some bongo drums on the beach, and he's dancing like crazy, and everybody's going, woo, you know, Boris, go ahead, you know, and they start circling around him, and he looks at me, and he's going like this to me, and I'm like, oh, no, I don't know you very well, you know, and it took me to sobriety to learn how to dance, and I love to dance, but, you know, I just didn't have any rhythm. I felt all stiff. I don't know these people. I don't speak the language. They push me into the middle. He's teaching me how to Latin dance, and before you know it, I'm in there. He's just telling me, Bob, you put your arms in like this, and you get up on your toes, and then you just let it go, and you just start circling around and loosen up, you know, and woo, you know, and there I am on the beaches of Ecuador, like, yeah, you know. And I'm like, I'm somebody now. I'm part of you, you know. I'm fitting in. Oh, my God. Isn't service great? So, oh, man. And so, you know, what a great time. And everybody's dancing, having a good time, and rolling my sleeves up. We get back on the bus, and we're going up this mountain somewhere. And I'm sort of zoned out, looking out the window at the sights of this incredible poverty I've never seen, and glass bottles smashed into the top of concrete to keep people from scaling walls, and just like amazed and seeing these parts of the world. I'd never hardly been out of Westfield, you know, New York City when I was a delegate, that was it. And so then, you know, these guys are like they're having a great time and they're singing and that kind of thing, and I'm not really paying attention. And the next thing you know, I start hearing, Bub, 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 and they start chanting, Bub, 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 and I'm like, oh no, I kind of lost the how I felt like I knew you before, you know, I'm not doing that, they want me to sing, you know, and they're edging me to sing, and I'm like, and I love to sing, but I couldn't think of anything, I was like on the spot, and the only thing I could come up with was Mercedes-Benz by Janis Joplin. So I give it my best effort, you know, I'm like, oh, Lord, you know, and I let them have it, and they're flicking their lighters on in the bus. they don't even know what I'm singing, you know. Oh, my God. So they're like, ay, 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 and I'm like, oh, Lord, you know. And then they took me to a karaoke bar, and I did it again, and there. You know, this is the fun that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we loosen up, you know, and then we get back into committees with suits and ties and dresses and all this stuff, and we're just, you know, and we're together, and we're comforted, and we're doing our thing and trying to carry the message. And what an experience, an incredible week. And, you know, then I get to the last day, and we're ready to finish up, and we finished up with this thing they called a congreso. And the congreso is like sort of like an assembly thing like this, mixed with like a state convention. And so they asked us all to share our stories, experience, strength, and hope. And so there's delegates from all over South and Central America, North America, and we all share our stories. And we get done, and they're taking pictures like crazy down there. And these people are trying to get me out of the room, and these people still want to take pictures. And this one guy, as I'm walking out of the room, goes, picture, 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 picture. And I said, okay, you know, and so I stopped to take a picture with the guy, and we take our picture, and he looks at me, and he gives me a hug, and he pulls me in tight, and he doesn't let me go, you know, and it feels like 5 minutes. I'm like, I didn't really know what was going on, you know, and it's probably 40 seconds, but I was like, you know, and I could sense something wasn't right, you know. And so he finally released me. And I look at him, and he's got tears streaming down his face. And his friend says, 30 days. 30 days, you know. And I was just like, wow. And you know what? That's the hope of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that guy was sitting there listening to all of these people come from all these distances, sharing their experience, strength, and hope about all these experiences in service and their sobriety and all that kind of thing. And he felt hope. And that's what we're there for. And that's why we do these things. That's why we put these dollars in the basket. That's part of the reason, is that they end up going to our General Service Board to pay for these kinds of things and to carry these types of messages. And they drop those dollars in the basket in Costa Rica, in Mexico, in Honduras, in Nicaragua, and all over. And just an amazing experience. And, you know, let me fast forward, and I get to my first World Service meeting, and representing our structure and learning about AA around the world, and delegates from all over the world giving their country highlights, talking about how AA has developed in their particular countries, and hearing the pitfalls and the cultural difficulties that they have to try to get to a point to be able to have enough money to come to an event like this, or enough servants to come to events like this. And there was this fellow, his name was Ali, he was a delegate from Iran, and he was sharing this story about AA in Iran, and that and how they have such strict Islamic laws, and Alcoholics Anonymous is illegal there, you know, and so they have to have their meetings underground, you know, where in people's houses or outside, and temperatures can range from 5 below 0 to 105 degrees above, you know, and they find a way to do it, and they have to actually refer to Alcoholics Anonymous as nameless sobers, because if they hear Alcoholics Anonymous, then they might kill them, you know. I mean, it's very dangerous for the fellowship to exist in some of these other nations. But, you know, they've been able to maintain AA there in Iran, and they've grown to over 8,000 members, and they've translated the Big Book into Farsi, you know. And it's working. And it might not be a great translation, but it's working. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is finding its way. Or recently, at my last World Service meeting, the delegate from Poland shared about a sponsorship, country-to-country sponsorship story, you know, where Poland identified a neighboring country, Moldova, was celebrating, going to be celebrating shortly 25 years of the inception of Alcoholics Anonymous in Moldova, and they had one AA group after 25 years because of the difficulties of trying to getting AA going, the language barriers, all of those kinds of things. So Poland reached out, and they invited a few members to come to Poland and to attend their service workshops, sponsorship workshops, traditions workshops, and they did that. And they inspired them by inviting them, and they lit a spark there, you know. And so then Poland decided to travel to Moldova, and they gathered a contingent of people from Ukraine, from Romania, from Finland, even Scotland somebody flew in from. And the important piece to that was that there could be many different people speaking different languages to match the different languages that were in Moldova. And not so much to just talk about that service message, but to offer true recovery sponsorship that they had no ability to do. And they did that. And you know, the huge victory of that is now in Moldova, just that was about a year and a half ago that happened. Moldova now has 6 groups and an intergroup. How cool is that, you know? I mean, that is a mushroom effect of carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and just unbelievable. And you know, the stories and things that we run into, I chaired a state convention in my home state, Massachusetts, about, I don't know what it was, 15 years or so ago, and I ordered a speaker tape at the time to choose my speaker. And I heard this woman, she inspired me, and I called her to come speak at our convention, and she told the story about how her husband, her name was Jan from Spokane, and some of you might have known her, I don't know, and her husband was Fran from Spokane, and her husband went to Romania, and he ended up starting Alcoholics Anonymous in a very God incidents type of a way, you know, and here I am at my first World Service meeting in Poland, and Romania was there for the first time being accepted into that fold and had grown up over those years to be strong enough to come to the World Service meeting. And the delegate got up there and said, 17 years ago, someone from your country came and brought the message to Romania, and here I am today standing in front of you representing my country, you know, and carrying the message with inspiration and with hope. just truly, truly unbelievable. Or Japan, I mentioned that I was going to share just a little bit more about my experience there. 40 years of A in Japan, and listening to these old-timers on the stage that were sober for that amount of time on the stage, with that deep culture, you know, of their Buddhist nature and their philosophy of their religion and that sort of thing, who were very concerned about accepting the concept of a higher power when AA got there in 1975. And they sat back and they said, why don't we just give this a shot and listen to what the Americans are telling us and see if it works. And they, and the fellow shared, in short order, we realized that it just was not that big of a deal. And he said it made all the difference, you know. And so there they are now, and they have 150,000 members in that country now over that time that have embraced Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this is a different time for me. I rotated 3 weeks ago to the day. I ended up chairing the last General Service Board meeting because our board chair had to go homesick. And so I officially called for the slate of the new officers, which I wasn't one of them, and down went the gavel, and I was out. I literally voted myself out of a job, you know? So that was my last conference, but it was such a privilege. It was such a special experience to be able to serve there those 4 years as a trustee. And I passed the gavel to our new board chair, Michelle, that's coming in. And I just felt so so privileged to be able to do that. You know, I don't know what to expect. A lot of people ask me, like, what are you going to do with yourself now? Are you going to go to Disney World? And are you going to take a vacation? I don't really have any plans. And all I can tell you is that, you know, I've embraced the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as I said, as enthusiastically as I could. And I look at my life realistically, and I think all of us, we can equate it to we're like a pie. And there's many different sections of our lives. And my trusteeship had become a very, very big part of my life, as it should have been, because I needed to give it everything I had. You know, I'm still a father and a husband and all those things, and maybe I'll expand some of those things around that will fill up that area that's just sort of been taken out. And maybe some new opportunities will present themselves to me that will sort of take that. But I can't make those things necessarily happen, you know? If there's some pain or some healing or some crying or whatever the feelings are that happen from the slice that's taken out, it's okay, you know? And I can recognize it for what it is. I can acknowledge it. I can talk about it. I can stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous and just let that naturally become something else. And so I'm not going to try to force anything to happen. And I'm so grateful for, you know, these opportunities to be here that keep me connected to Alcoholics Anonymous. I truly appreciate it. You know, AA is in 175 countries, which essentially we say is every country in the world, right? You know, on any given day, some country thinks they own another one, so who knows how many we have out there, you know? And of that, there are roughly 62, I think, GSOs, General Service Offices, and or General Service Board, autonomous boards or offices. And my question is, and what I hope that we continue to pursue, is that certainly to stay focused on what's happening in those 62 and to provide experience, strength, and hope for them, for all of us to sponsor each other, to reach out to help each other into the World Service Meeting fold, into our Zonal Meeting fold, our Rodellas, and those types of things. But what's happening between the 62 and the 175? Sometimes the record that we have is a meeting that we heard about in 1982 that we don't know that's happening anymore. And we really need to continue to reach out and to bridge those gaps and to find those opportunities that we can actually reach out or talk amongst other nations and find out who can do it best. Or maybe we need to do it together. And I think that's incumbent upon all of us, because you all come from different nationalities, especially in the United States, where the melting pot, you know. And so you might find that there's something happening or something not happening in some country, and you should bring that to the attention of your delegate. You know, and I hope we get to a point where we find that there is an international conference committee where there is not now, that will get more connected to the fellowship to be able to carry this message. We are a worldwide fellowship, and we are leaders in that, and I think that we need to do that. And I hope you all remember that. You know, when you exercise your participation in the seventh tradition, and that's part of where this money goes, that you're truly carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous around the world. And money and spirituality truly do mix. And the other piece that comes to that participation is service. And if you think you're not good enough to stand to be the next delegate or alternate delegate or trustee or DCM or GSR, then you probably are the perfect candidate for that. You're the ones we need. It means you're good and humble, you know? And we need you for that. Service stretches us. It puts us in a position where we feel uncomfortable, and I think that's where our higher power wants us to go. And AA service gives us that opportunity. So please don't be fearful and discern your higher power's will. Keep your hand in the air and make yourself available and let him make the choice. We need you. If you don't stand and make yourselves available for these types of service opportunities, someone in the world may never find the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't necessarily see what our particular service work does and where it lands, but it trickles and it finds a way. And it is so important. So again, if anyone anywhere in the world reaches out for help, we want the hand of AA always to be there. And for that, we are all responsible. Thank you so very much for the time here with you this weekend and for your attention.